Welcome to Victory Over Communism with Bill Gertz, the only program willing to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. Your host and guide to victory over communism is one of the nation's most experienced national security journalists, Bill Gertz, who uses unique facts, pinpoint analysis, and exclusive interviews to identify and counter today's destructive communist ideologies. Now, Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.
Welcome to the podcast. This program is about ideology, communist ideology, and it offers a critique of its tenets and a faith-based counterproposal. I also present news and an interview with an expert on communist ideology. I like to make the point that this program's not about people. I intend no animus towards anyone. Our democratic system gives each person the freedom to believe in whatever they like. My goal here is to educate people to the errors and falsehoods of communist ideology and Marxist ideology, and present some new ideas for solving some of the fundamental problems that have been exploited by communists in their drive for creating a world under Marxism-Leninism. This episode is going to examine Chinese communism and the recently concluded Chinese Communist Party Congress in Beijing. The twice-a-decade meeting provided new details on Chinese Supreme Leader Xi Jinping and his drive for absolute power and ultimately global domination. The Party Congress represented the most aggressive effort to date to place China's 1.4 billion people under the yoke of Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics. This was outlined in a speech October 22nd by Xi Jinping, who at the Congress did away with term limits for himself and took on an unprecedented third term as General Secretary of the CCP, and, most importantly, Chairman of the Central Military Commission, the ultimate organ of power in China. What Mao was talking about when he famously said that political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. The speech's title has echoes of North Korea's totalitarian system. Hold high the great banner of socialism with Chinese characteristics and strive in unity to build a modern socialist country in all respects. Xi reveals in his speech that the party, until he took over in 2012, lacked a clear understanding and effective action, and that the rule of the party was actually threatened. He decried what he said was a slide towards weak, hollow, and watered-down party leadership in practice. Some party apparatchiks were actually wavering in their political conviction to communism, according to Xi. Despite repeated warnings, pointless formalities, bureaucratism, hedonism, and extravagance persisted in some localities and departments. Privilege-seeking mindsets and practices posed a serious problem, and some deeply shocking cases of corruption had been uncovered, according to Xi. According to him, some CCP cadres lacked confidence in the communist political system with Chinese characteristics, while laws were ignored or not strictly enforced. He also blamed misguided patterns of thinking, money worship, hedonism, ecocentricity, historical nihilism, and online discourse, he said, was rife with disorder. The lack of ideological fervor had a grave impact on people's thinking and the public opinion environment, he said in his speech. The systems for safeguarding national security also were said to be inadequate, and China's capacity, the party's capacity for responding to major risk, was insufficient. This situation threatened the party's rule and security and stability of the country. According to Xi, in the past 10 years, he has stayed committed to Marxism-Leninism, Mao Zedong thought, Deng Xiaoping theory, the theory of the three represents, and the scientific outlook on development. And he said that the party had implemented his ideology, which he calls thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for a new era. The reference to these versions are all part of the past leaders, communist leaders, and their own variation on Marxism-Leninism. Xi's version, again, his version of communism is thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for the new era. And he has made this the core element of the Constitution. He actually put it in the Constitution. Not the Constitution of China, the government, but the Constitution of the Chinese Communist Party. The ideology is Marxism-Leninism, and it is being heavily promoted through schools and universities where students are required to study the false anti-capitalist ideology. Abroad, Chinese communism is being spread under the guise of the Belt and Road Initiative, an infrastructure development plan ostensibly to build up infrastructure in the developing world. In reality, this is a ruse to expand CCP power globally. Xi is also reintroducing the personality cult leadership that has not been seen since the murderous excesses under Mao Zedong, when more than 60 million Chinese died from communism and its policies. Under Xi, communist ideology demands support for the core, which is the neo-Maoist leader and his Marxist-Leninist policies, under the rubric of Xi's China Dream, an anti-U.S. counterpoint to the American Dream, and national rejuvenation that in reality is a return to hardline communism and all of the excesses of the false credo. Two programs were explained by Xi. They called the Five-Spear Integrated Plan that calls for promoting economic, political, cultural, social, and economic advancement, and the Four-Pronged Comprehensive Strategy that emphasizes building a modern communist system and strengthening party self-governance, i.e., rule by Xi Jinping. The lies of the communist leader were manifold, and as I've said many times, lying and deception are key features of communism. They have done this throughout history, and they do it to fool not just the people that they're ruling, but to fool themselves. So here's my reality check on some of the lies. First of all, Xi falsely claimed and declared that communist political advancement includes people's democracy, which is actually a euphemism for rule by dictatorship of the proletariat, a key communist tenet. Xi also stated that under his rule, a foundational system was created to ensure the dominant role of Marxism in all matters of ideology that he said has been embraced by the Chinese people and controlled online. In reality, Marxism is a false ideology that at its root involves a denial of God. As I've explained in earlier podcasts, this fundamental flaw in Marxism is the most blatant and most dangerous. For once God is removed, there will be no morality, paving the way for gross violations of human rights, including massacres of those who do not accept communist ideology. Xi Jinping asserted that his regime has improved life for ethnic minorities. In reality, China is engaged in a genocide in Xinjiang against minority Uyghurs who are being exterminated under Beijing's policies that involve mass imprisonment in concentration camps. The Chinese leader repeated the fiction that his communist campaign to eradicate poverty has ended absolute poverty. His own premier, Li Keqiang, who is being ousted following the Party Congress, had said earlier, in what appeared to be a contradiction of Xi's wild assertion of ending poverty, that 600 million Chinese are earning paltry wages and are unable to survive in the system. Xi hailed the brutal crackdown on pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong as a move to place, quote, patriots in charge of the government there. He also said a new national security law was enacted, but in reality, there is no rule of law, only decrees by the CCP. More importantly, Xi blatantly violated China's agreement made after Britain turned over control of Hong Kong that it would allow the democratic system to continue until at least 2047. Xi also said that the policy of one country, two systems was implemented there. False. In reality, it is no longer two systems. Both China and Hong Kong are firmly under the grip of communist ideology. On Taiwan, Xi said that the party has strengthened its strategic initiative for a takeover of Taiwan, a takeover that U.S. officials recently warned could come in the next several years. Xi also announced that unspecified efforts to internationally to blackmail, contain, blockade, and exert maximum pressure on China were being resisted. This was a reference to differences with the United States. In reality, it is the CCP under Xi that has sought to use blackmail, coercion, and maximum pressure to expand its power and influence in places like the South China Sea, the Taiwan Strait, and the East China Sea near Japan's Senkaku Islands. Xi also said that China under his rule has protected the environment, another complete falsehood. China today is the most polluted nation on earth, and its reckless disregard for the environment should lead all environmentalists of good conscience to oppose Chinese communist ideology. Xi said that China opposes bullying, but that has been the main feature of China's foreign policy under his rule, whether in debt trap diplomacy of the Belt and Road Initiative or the heavy-handed military threats and exercises against Taiwan. On corruption, Xi outlined the steps taken to crack down what most Chinese know to be lies. His signature purge of political opponents that netted thousands of officials in both the party and military had nothing to do with opposing corruption. The steps were designed to hide his consolidation of power. Anti-corruption has been a major narrative for communists seeking to eliminate rivals and shore up their own power. Xi declared an overwhelming victory in the battle against corruption was on a scale unprecedented in the history. He described the effort as a combination of take out tigers, swat flies, hunt down foxes, and punishing officials of all types. Again, corruption is integral to the Chinese communist system, to the point where the entire CCP operates more like an organized crime syndicate than a political party. Xi asserted that over the past 100 years, China had tempered itself through revolution and grown stronger while maintaining a close bond with the people. In reality, there is no bond between China's people and the 96 million members of the CCP who are despised or feared. Perhaps the most striking feature of the Party Congress speech were the explanations of the role of communist ideology in the CCP's actions. Marxism is the fundamental guiding ideology upon which the party and the country are founded and thrive, he said. The experience taught them that at the fundamental level, they owe the success of their party and socialism to the fact that Marxism works, particularly when it is adapted to the Chinese context and the needs of our times. Communism is the basis upon which the CCP is seizing the historical initiative. What is that historical initiative? It is the false idea that history is marching inexorably towards a utopian ideal world of a workers' paradise, an ideal that will never be realized because it is based on a false economic and political concept. That is, the reality, the truth, is that Marxism-Leninism has produced mass death, tyranny, and a complete lack of freedom in every place that has been imposed. Yet, Xi falsely asserted that Chinese communism is a process of seeking and revealing and applying truth. Truth is whatever the communists want to use in order to advance their goals and to maintain power. According to Xi, based on current world ideological conditions and the ideological conditions inside China, quote, there is an urgent need for us to provide in-depth theoretical and practical answers to a series of epical questions on the cause of the party and the country, as well as the party's governance of China. The key to this ideological assault is none other than Xi's version of communism, as I mentioned, the thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for a new era. Chinese communists are keenly aware that only by integrating the basic tenets of Marxism with China's specific realities and fine traditional culture, and only by applying dialectical and historical materialism, can provide correct answers to the major questions presented by the times and discovered through practice, and can ensure that Marxism always retains vigor and vitality. Dialectical materialism and historical materialism are central features of the God-denying ideology of communism. that has been proven wrong since first postulated in the 1800s. For Xi, ideological fervor is lacking, so Marxism has to be integrated with Chinese nationalism. Yet the Chinese leader fails to recognize that Marxism-Leninism is a foreign ideology that has no linkage to Chinese history or traditions. It is based on opposing capitalism, an economic system that has produced greater human advancement than at any time in history, along with Marxism's hatred of Christianity and seeking to solve the problems of human nature that only religion and religious ideology ultimately can solve. Xi urges continuing what he called the people-centeredness of Marxism. In truth, Marxism has been used to divide humanity into a cherished designated historical class, that it's workers in the West and peasants in China, and everyone else that must be eliminated according to the dictates of the zero-sum ideology of Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics. Xi is a true believer, and stated in his speech that China is in the primary stage of socialism, of course the last step before communism, and is undergoing profound social transformation. As for the CCP's global ambitions, Xi stated that a global vision is required. Beyond China, the CCP is pursuing, quote, human progress and world harmony, and to building a better world, that is communist dictatorship. As I wrote in my book, Deceiving the Sky, more than 40 years of appeasement toward communist China must be ended. The United States urgently needs a new strategic approach to mitigating the most serious national security threat facing our country and the world, and that's from the People's Republic of China. This threat from China is multi-pronged, extremely dangerous, and metastasizing like the deadliest cancer. The China threat is much more than the growing danger of a surprise nuclear or conventional missile strike. It is ideological, political, diplomatic, military, intelligence, economic, financial, and informational. Compounding the threat is Beijing's imperialistic drive to achieve world dominance under the Chinese Communist Party and Xi's dark vision of a China dream, a world ruled under a corrupt and ruthless kleptocracy unchecked by a powerless and defeated America. The dictatorship of the Communist Party of China is evil and a danger that cannot be wished away with feel-good bromides, which were the basis of U.S. policies towards China between 1979 and 2017, when a major shift in strategic direction began. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz. Featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
Hi, this is Bill Gertz. I wanted to talk to you briefly about my latest book. It's called Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. This is the most important book you can read to fully understand the threat posed by the Chinese Communist government. I urge you to get a copy today. It can be found at my website, The Gertz File, that's gertzfile.com, or at the book site called deceivingthesky.com.
If you enjoy listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, please consider helping Bill with his important work of educating patriots just like you about how communism is very real and even more dangerous than ever before. Your donation to the Victory Over Communism program will help expand its reach across America and throughout the world. In fact, you'll be helping to provide the kind of information that may well make its way behind the new Iron Curtain and the Great Firewall of China and inspire those living under communism to seek freedom. Supporting the Victory Over Communism program is easy. Just visit the program website, victoryovercommunism.net, and click on the link at the bottom to gofundme.com. Again, just visit victoryovercommunism.net and click on the link to gofundme.com. Thanks for listening, and God bless America.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. This is the counterproposal section of the program, what I call the spiritual section. It's based on the teachings of the late Reverend Sun Myung Moon, whose divine principle is a unique and revolutionary revelation, providing a clear and modern understanding of God and his plan for restoring humankind. Communism's central feature is a denial of God. The VOC worldview that provides a critique and counterproposal to Marxism-Leninism provides a common sense proof of God, a key first step in understanding and countering communist ideology. So, I'm going to begin with a question. Have centuries of philosophical thought produced any convincing proof of God? The fact is, they produced a bewildering array of proofs of God, along with a bewildering array of critiques of those proofs. The German theologian Hans Küng wrote a best-selling book, 800 pages long, entitled Does God Exist? In it, he examines scores of arguments and counterarguments. However, I'm not ready to plunge headlong into treacherous waters of that theological debate. Furthermore, I'm going to avoid the technicalities of these sophisticated discussions. Instead, let's take a common sense look at the proofs of God. I'm going to consider the question by using analogy. If I were giving this talk in a lecture hall, there would be many man-made objects in the auditorium. There are lights, a podium, microphones, and speakers. Did these things come about by chance? No, absolutely not. First, someone made these things. Even prior to making them, there must have been a necessity and a distinct purpose. Second, that purpose was not conceived by the object which was created. The purpose was first conceived in the mind of the Creator. All these objects existed first in an invisible form in someone's mind. Then they were projected into reality, not randomly or by whim, but by will. The same principle may also be applied to the creation of the universe. Nature and humans could not come into being without the action of an organizing, willful creator. Likewise, there must also have been a distinct purpose that preceded the creation of the universe. The whole creation was initiated with purpose, existed first as an idea in the mind of the Creator, and became manifest in reality. That is the process of creation. By scientific analysis and analogical reasoning, we are led to the understanding that there must be someone existing prior to the universe who conceived the purpose of the universe, designed it, and willed it into reality. That someone must possess the cosmic or universal mind. We can call that someone by many names, God, Jehovah, Allah, etc. However you name him, it does not change the truth. The truth is that there is a creator, God. To fulfill God's distinct purpose, all things were created. God is a being of heart and emotion. All the objects that can be seen around us serve a definite purpose. Purpose always precedes creation. The maker or creator conceived the purpose before beginning to create. That is, the act of creation is carried out to fulfill a definite purpose. That is, to satisfy the desires felt by the creator. How did the plan of creation become a reality? Through what process did God create? To understand the process of creation, let us use the analogy of a sound amplification system. Before any product can be manufactured, there must be a purpose in the manufacturer's mind which it would serve. The purpose in this case is to amplify sound so everyone in an auditorium can hear a lecture. The necessity or the purpose exists before the substantial amplification system. How then is the purpose fulfilled? To substantially fulfill the purpose, the various parts of the human mind come into play. The mind of a person consists of three components: emotion, intellect, and will. Emotion is the center of those three. First, someone feels that their purpose must be fulfilled. Emotion. Knowledge, know-how, is then needed to generate a design. But knowledge alone is not enough. A design is still not a reality. For a design to become reality, will or drive comes into play. In general, then, this is how everything is made. Purpose gives rise first to feeling, second to knowledge, and third to will. These correspond to the three components of the human mind. In order to create and fulfill the purpose, these three components of the mind must work together. The creative work of God is centered on purpose. 1. Within the heart of God, the seat of emotion, purpose is felt. 2. Within the intellect of God, purpose is understood and the design and plan of creation is generated. 3. Within the will of God, the determination and drive develops to fulfill the purpose and carry out the creative act. What is the most important part of God's mind? Like the human mind, made in His image, the core of God's mind is emotion or heart. Emotion is as central for God as it is for humans. Human emotion is the ultimate source of desire. Just as human beings have the ability to feel emotions, God has the ability to feel every sadness, joy, loneliness, and pain. Even more than human beings, God experiences a vast spectrum of emotions. Sometimes we don't realize that God is a God of emotion. We can totally misunderstand and think God is like a supercomputer having infinite knowledge, infinite will, and infinite power. Our concept of God may resemble that of a giant robot with no heart or feeling. This would be a huge error in our understanding of God. God is first of all a God of emotion. Therefore, He has a capability to understand love and feel it. He is an infinite personality with a truly sensitive heart, watching every human affair and participating in every human drama. He watches His children and experiences their joys and sufferings, shares their emotions with the deepest heart of a devoted parent. The purpose of God's creation is humankind. Finally, we must know why God created all things and humankind. What was His purpose in creating? Along with the question of the existence of God, this is among the most fundamental and crucial questions of life. No religion or philosophy has yet completely answered this question. But without this essential understanding, human life cannot help but be faced with confusion and chaos. Creation should fulfill the purpose of the Creator. God intended that all humankind would know the purpose of God's creation and live for that purpose. Only in this way can we feel fulfillment and happiness. When we try to live for another purpose, confusion and unhappiness follow. To achieve happiness, then, we must understand the purpose of creation. Why did God create humans? We can approach this question by asking another question. Why does anyone do what they do in life? Every living person has a certain ambition. Some want to succeed in business, make a lot of money, and become millionaires. Others study hard to become accomplished and recognized scholars. There are some who are working day and night to become virtuosos in music or highly accomplished in other forms of art. Others still give their utmost effort to become a champion athlete. Have you ever asked yourself, why am I doing this? Most of us, upon reflection, have come to feel that knowledge, honor, wealth, and fame cannot be the ultimate goals in life. Suppose you attain wealth and honor, accomplishment and fame. What will all these things do for you? How are they good for you? What then is the ultimate purpose, the innermost purpose in life? The answer to this question may be simpler than you realize. Is not the most important purpose for each of us to be happy? We want most of all to feel joy and satisfaction. We may seek after knowledge, wealth, honor, accomplishment, and fame, but only because we know that these provide us with happiness. Happiness or emotional satisfaction is the bottom line. God, being a God of emotion, must have the same emotional goals. This explains why God created humankind. God wants to experience happiness. Unlike humans, God does not need money, power, or knowledge. These things would not give God any joy or satisfaction. God would seem to have everything and have no need of such things. God is already the king of knowledge. He has the power to create, and He has no need for wealth. All creation is His. What else is there that would give joy to God? Love. Love is the only thing that gives God joy. Love is the one thing that God cannot experience all by Himself. Love, by its nature, demands a reciprocal relationship. There must be a complete circuit for the exchange of love. God needs someone to love and someone to love him in return. In the position of that someone, God created humans. Humans are God's object, able to receive God's love and return love back to God. In this exchange of love, God can experience joy. So God created men and women to receive his love and respond to his love. Human beings are the children of God. Without men and women, God cannot derive his joy and satisfaction. When men and women receive the love of God and return their love to him, God experiences great joy. Humankind is created to constantly stimulate God with love. This and this alone will satisfy God. Humans are God's masterpiece and supreme creation because humans are able to return God's love and be the source of his greatest joy. I'll be right back.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
Welcome back. In this news portion of the podcast, I'm going to discuss the situation in Taiwan and the growing danger of a war between China and Taiwan that in all likelihood will involve the United States, along with major regional allies. I recently returned from Hawaii, where I was honored to present a speech to an annual conference co-hosted by the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, the military joint command that would be in charge of handling any conflict with China. The visit and my remarks on the question of whether or not the U.S. military would defend Taiwan in the event of an attack by the Chinese military took place in the context of what is clearly a growing danger of a military conflict over Taiwan. The first indication of the increased risk of war was made by Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, October 17th. It was during a speech at the Hoover Institution in California. Blinken said, China is undermining the fragile status quo across the Taiwan Strait that has managed to keep the peace between China and Taiwan for decades. Now, Blinken said, China plans to, quote, pursue unification on a much faster timetable. 2 days later, Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Mike Gilday said in Washington at another think tank conference, it's not just what President Xi says, but it's how the Chinese behave and what they do. And what we've seen over the past 20 years is that they have delivered on every promise they've made earlier than what they have said they were going to deliver on it. Gilday said, when asked about the so-called Davidson window, he was referring to former U.S. Indo-Pacific Command Chief Admiral Phil Davidson, who testified to Congress in 2021 that China wanted the capability to seize Taiwan within the next 6 years. When we talk about the 2027 window, Gilday said, in my mind, that has to be a 2022 window or a potentially a 2023 window. I can't rule that out. I don't mean at all to be alarmist by saying that. It's just that we can't wish that away, the CNO added. A third indicator arrived during my visit to Hawaii. I interviewed Frank Pace. Frank is the administrator for Hawaii's Homeland Security at his office on Diamond Head. Pace told me he recently was part of a briefing for senior state officials, including the governor of Hawaii, on the threat from China. During the briefing, which included briefing slides he showed me, Pace said the timetable for a possible attack on Taiwan has speeded up. To me, this indicates there's new intelligence information within the government that the threat of an attack is dramatically increasing. We can only guess what the basis for the assessment is. I asked White House spokesman John Kirby, a retired admiral, about this, and he said he couldn't discuss intelligence information. I didn't ask him about intelligence information, so he indicated that. A while ago in May, Defense Intelligence Agency Director Lieutenant General Scott Barrier told a Senate hearing that the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, is making steady progress in building up forces specifically for an attack on Taiwan. In particular, the key indicators include the PLA strengthening joint warfighting capabilities. They're modernizing their command, control, computer intelligence, and information systems, and they're expanding the use of advanced technologies. Quote, these advances would give the PLA an improved ability to execute a number of military operations, including the invasion of Taiwan, General Barrier said. What are those options? They include coercive military activities, which have been taking place, increased military presence operation, that is sailing and flying around the island, an air and maritime blockade, we haven't seen that yet, or the seizure of Taiwan's smaller outlying islands. He also said that there could be, quote, a full-scale amphibious invasion of Taiwan itself. Barrier said that a senior Chinese official announced that key Chinese Communist Party decisions about Taiwan were to be made at the senior party congress that ended last week. Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, made clear during the congress that, quote, resolving the Taiwan question and realizing China's complete reunification is for the party a historical mission and an unshakable commitment. Unification, he asserted, is an historical inevitability, as communism's drive to the ideal workers' paradise. The wheels of history are rolling on towards China's reunification and the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. Rejuvenation, as I mentioned, is key, is code for spreading Chinese communism and ultimately achieving world domination by Chinese communists. China remains committed somewhat to peaceful unification under the now discredited one country, two systems policy that would provide an intermediate stage before a full takeover of the island. Xi warned, however, that the party must struggle and resort to military force if necessary against what he termed separatist and foreign forces. Chinese communist ideology on Taiwan justifies and requires escalating threats. But for a military invasion and occupation, the CCP will need to claim that Taiwan's de facto sovereignty poses an existential threat to Xi's revolutionary views. For this reason, Xi used the phrase, all necessary means in the course of taking control of Taiwan. Taiwan's existence as a free, democratic, and prosperous high-technology nation, it produces a majority of computer chips, is an existential threat to Chinese communism. Therefore, that democracy must be extinguished as part of China's goal of spreading Chinese communism around the world. Mark Harrison, a senior lecturer in Chinese studies at the University of Tasmania, says critiquing Beijing's Taiwan policy and communist ideology is a necessary step. Contrary to the Biden administration view of dealing with China as simply a great power in competition, without understanding China's communist ideology is a no-win proposition. Harrison says the great power model, quote, makes it harder to see that Beijing's Taiwan policy is an ideologically fixated assertion of party power that is disconnected from reality and points China towards potential catastrophe. So, how best to deter a war with China over Taiwan? This was the focus of my speech at Indo-PACOM. First, the current policy called strategic ambiguity must be abandoned in favor of a defense policy of more strategic clarity. China for decades has said if Taiwan declares independence, there will be war. But Taiwan is already independent, and China exercises no political control whatsoever. Under current U.S. policy, all relations with Beijing are predicated on China resolving its differences with Taiwan peacefully and without resort to force. Instead, China is taking steps for what it calls military preparation of the battle space. It has declared the Taiwan Strait its maritime territory, which in reality is international waters, and the U.S. government has recognized that as international waters and not China's territory. Also, China passed an anti-secessionist law, which was designed specifically to provide a quasi-legal justification for a future attack on Taiwan. China also is preparing to blame the United States for its anticipated attack on Taiwan, just as Beijing falsely blamed the U.S. for Russia's invasion of Ukraine and for falsely asserting that the COVID-19 pandemic was caused by the U.S. military. In fact, we know that the pandemic began in Wuhan and most likely was caused by a leak from the Wuhan Institute of Virology that was engaged in dangerous bat coronavirus manipulation, as well as doing secret work for the PLA, the Chinese military. The question of Taiwan's sovereignty also can be upgraded by the president or the secretary of state publicly declaring that the U.S. does not recognize Chinese sovereignty over Taiwan and takes no position on the matter. But the United States maintains a strong national interest in maintaining peace and security of the Western Pacific, and the United States will oppose any effort to change the status quo of Taiwan by force. That's the kind of statement that needs to be made. On China's threats of a war over a declaration of independence, the United States could say, if there is a war launched by Beijing, the United States will recognize Taiwan as an independent nation, as the independent nation that it already is. Congress as well could modify the 1979 Taiwan Relations Act, which provides a strong legal basis for a U.S. and allied defense of Taiwan, to include upgraded defense policy language. Unfortunately, the hour is late in deterring a war over Taiwan. At the same time a bolder policy on defense is worked out, the U.S. needs to better prepare for any attempt by China to use military force, and that appears increasingly likely under Xi Jinping. So first, we need to upgrade the training of the Taiwanese military into joint military exercises. The U.S. already provides training for the Taiwanese in their aircraft, their F-16s, and we need to begin with joint military exercise. We got to be ready for that. Also, we need to move more U.S. military assets to the Indo-Pacific region, including at least one and perhaps two Navy aircraft carrier strike groups to Guam. Right now, we only have one carrier strike group. It's based in Japan, and we need more. And that's just that's needed for deterrent. Also, more air and ground forces and submarines. Also, we need to build the sea-launched cruise missile. This is a nuclear cruise missile that was canceled by the Biden administration. They're seeking to reduce the role of nuclear weapons at a time when China is engaged in a massive buildup of nuclear forces, including 360 silos for multi-warhead DF-41 missiles in western China. Also, to assure that the U.S. could surge intelligence like that flowing to the Ukrainians for their defense against Russia, better data links need to be set up between the U.S. and Taiwanese military. And Taiwan has some problems with their inner service issues on that score, and they need to fix that problem. We need to be able to provide them with really good intelligence if they need it. Also, we need to increase counterintelligence support to Taiwan. This is a serious issue. Chinese intelligence has made penetrating Taiwan among its highest priorities. In the event of conflict, those penetrations could be used to decapitate, defeat, or otherwise limit Taiwan's government. Also, the U.S. needs to greatly increase information warfare and counter-information warfare operations against China and assist the Taiwan government in doing so. China is engaged in massive gray zone and information warfare operations. They're aggressively doing this, and Taiwan needs to be, they need help in countering that. Policy debates and disputes regarding Taiwan have been called the theology of Taiwan for their arcane formulation. To this, I would add my own paraphrase to the theology from the Bible verse of Luke chapter 17, verse 33. Whosoever shall seek to gain his life shall lose it, but whosoever shall lose his life shall preserve it. Although there are many similarities between the U.S. government's newer, more realistic approach to China and Taiwan that were put in place over the past 6 years, there's also stark differences. President Donald Trump advocated peace through strength as a means of deterring conflict. This was adopted from Ronald Reagan and first promoted by President George Washington. It was Washington who said, "If we desire to secure peace, one of the most powerful instruments of our rising prosperity, it must be known that we are at all times ready for war." By contrast, the Biden administration is following the weak policies of the administration of President Barack Obama, which has pursued a policy I call war avoidance. This has allowed aggressor states like China, steeped in the use of information operations, to manipulate U.S. policies by stepping up rhetoric warning of an impending war in order to shape those American policies in ways favorable to Beijing. A policy of peace through strength, or a similar approach under a different name, is urgently needed for the United States to maintain and promote the democratic free market system that has provided the most advancement and prosperity in human history. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
Hi, this is Bill Gertz. I spoke to you earlier about my book, Deceiving the Sky. I also wanted to urge you to take a look at another book that I wrote called iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. We live in an information age, and yet we're getting bombarded with enemy propaganda coming at us from all different directions. iWar really helps expose what we need to do and how we need to counter it. I urge you to get a copy. It'll be the natural order of daily life. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
Welcome back. I'm joined now by Bradley Thayer. Brad is the Director of China Policy at the Center for Security Policy in Washington and co-author of the book, Understanding the China Threat. Brad, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much, Bill. It's an honor to be with you today.
You recently wrote an excellent commentary on the Chinese Communist Party's 20th Party Congress. What are some of the implications from the events at the week-long Congress that threaten to affect U.S. national security?
Well, to my mind, it's the greatest threat to American national security that we have faced since the end of the Cold War. And this is because, first, Xi Jinping has declared war on the United States, and that was evinced in his speech to the 20th Party Congress. That's not to say, of course, that that was new, that he had been expressing his intent to challenge the United States and supplant the United States in international politics for many years before. But again, we had that most recent iteration and a very clear iteration of his intent. Secondly, Xi also advanced, of course, his fidelity to communism, and it's the importance of Marxism through Lenin, through Stalin, through Mao, to Xi Jinping's own thought, which is very important for Americans and for all members of your audience to understand that we have really Xi Jinping is a fervent believer in that ideology. And of course, that's a violent ideology which targets the West and the United States particularly. Thirdly, Bill, of course, because of the direct threat to Taiwan, which was unalloyed, very direct, which he expressed. So all of those reasons, those three reasons, are very salient. Additionally, I would add that what we need in response to that address is leadership. We need the United States as the leader of the free world to respond to what Xi has stated. And sadly, we have not had from the Biden administration the necessary leadership with respect to the challenges, the gauntlet, which has been thrown down by Xi Jinping as leader of the CCP. Our enemy has revealed himself as an enemy. The enemy has said explicitly, and that's rare in international politics, when you have an enemy who says so overtly that he's coming after you, and that compels a U.S. response as leader of the free world. And simply, Bill, we have not had that from the Biden administration, and that is necessary before we can husband our resources to deal with the existential threat that we face from the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, you said we need a better strategy. What would that strategy look like? What should the Biden administration do to better address the threat from China?
Three things, Bill. Immediately, identify the CCP as an enemy of the United States, and directly so. No partnership, no competitor, but an enemy. The CCP isn't shy about calling us an enemy, and so likewise, we should recognize the scale, the scope of the threat that we face, and identify the Communist Party of China and its leader Xi Jinping as enemies of the United States and of the free world, additionally of the Chinese people, given the tyranny of the Chinese Communist Party over the Chinese people. Secondly, we need to develop a strategy of response. Recognizing that the CCP is an enemy of the U.S., we need to have leadership with respect to how we respond. How is it that the United States is going to deploy all of its assets, military, diplomatic, ideological, economic, financial, etc., to address the enemy? And again, sadly, the Biden administration is failing on leadership, and that's absolutely necessary. Perhaps if there is a Republican Congress, a House and a Senate, then perhaps a Republican Congress might be able to take leadership in that respect. But we're failing. We simply don't have it with respect to the Biden administration at this time. Thirdly, we need to ensure that we have the ability to deter coercive measures against U.S. allies and partners, and that includes Taiwan in the Indo-Pacific, from coercive measures that the CCP is likely to execute against Taiwan. But of course, we need to be cognizant that East China Sea, Senkaku Island dispute, for example, as you well know, Bill, and have documented so often, or South China Sea, again, as you've documented in countless times, or against India or elsewhere. Coercive measures anywhere need to be addressed through a robust U.S. deterrent, but certainly against Taiwan, given that Xi Jinping has declared his intent to conquer Taiwan. So we need to have, the U.S. needs to have immediately, the U.S. needs to have a conventional and nuclear deterrent to ensure that Taiwan will not fall prey to the CCP's depredations directed against that. And sadly, as you well know, we don't have the adequate posture in terms of conventional or nuclear capabilities in that regard. And it's with great regret that I note that the National Defense Strategy has just come out and not in support of or pulling support for SLCM, which you know is a very important aspect of our deterrent, so that we have some type of theater capability in the region. So ideally, a Republican Congress will be able to reverse the Biden administration's egregious decision on the nuclear-armed sea-launched cruise missile. So, Bill, there's much work to be done and very little time in which to do it.
Right. Yeah, we're talking with Brad Thayer. He's Director of China Policy at the Center for Security Policy and co-author of the book Understanding the China Threat. Earlier in the podcast, I highlighted the ideological elements of Xi Jinping's recent speech to the Party Congress. And it appears from that he's engaged in a major revamping of what they call Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics. She also made the point that communism is not only for the Chinese people, but for, quote, humanity. This seems to be a new wrinkle in Beijing's promotion of communism.
Well, indeed it does. And in some respects, that's just old school communism with the belief from Marx and Engels through Lenin, Stalin, and Mao that the rest of the world needs to suffer under the tyranny of Marxism, Leninism, Maoism. But it's still a very important development where he is now describing or proclaiming his intent to ensure that communism becomes the dominant ideology of the 21st century. And of course, the dispositive question of the 21st century is whether freedom advanced by the free world is still going to be the dominant force or whether it will be replaced by the tyranny of communism from China. And Xi is doing everything he can to advance that. I'd also note, of course, his recognition that China is moving now towards its second centenary goals of creating a modern socialist nation and rejuvenation of the Chinese people. And that is explicitly a call or for the recognition that China can now set the rules, the norms, the principles of international politics. He's saying that China is now going to rule, and it's going to rule with communist ideology. And again, this requires leadership. There has to be, obviously, the response to that from the Biden administration that no, that's not the future. The future is still freedom, free markets, liberty, and the freedoms that we enjoy in human rights, that we enjoy in the liberal international order. And again, regrettably, we do not see that leadership from the Biden administration, which opens the space for Xi to make these both outlandish and equally horrifying claims about how the future is going to be one of tyranny. It's not going to be one of freedom.
Yeah. One of the key features of Marxism-Leninism is the use of lies and deception. And in the case of Xi Jinping, we saw this very clearly. On almost all the major issues, there were basically lies. For example, he talked about China's treatment of ethnic minorities, and yet they're engaged in genocide against the Uyghurs. He talked about restoring order to Hong Kong, where he has violated the agreement to allow that democratic system to flourish until 2047. There were many other elements of this. You know, what is it about communism that they do not like to tell the truth, and especially to deceive the world about their goals? And in this case, Chinese communism. What is Xi Jinping hiding behind these lies and deceptions?
Well, because at root, communism is an ideology which is an aspect of tyranny. It's oppressive. It is absolutely at variance with the human spirit and what humans want. Freedom, the ability to express yourself, the ability to enjoy life as you wish it, the ability to enjoy life to its fullest. All of that is negated by communism and that ideology, which again is a totalitarian ideology which seeks to crush humanity and replace it with a vindictive and tyrannous form of government for the advantage of a small number of individuals at the top of the party. So it is the negation of the human condition. It's the negation of human freedom and what humans seek, and which we have enjoyed in the free world, of course, and that needs to be defended. So it's not a surprise that communists lie because they can't tell the truth. The truth is a negation of humanity, and so they have to embrace lies about a better future. And again, it's always in the future, right, when things are going to get better, in order to mask the form of government that they seek to impose. So anyone with a familiarity of communism, of course, understands that fundamental point. And it's sad that part of the reason why Xi Jinping has been able to advance this message and the CCP have been able to advance this message is because there has been tremendous ignorance about what communism is in the last few decades, certainly since the end of the Cold War. And that's widespread among American elite as well as among Western peoples and peoples of the world. And that needs to be addressed through education about the true nature of communism and the reasons why the leopard never changes its spots. It's always the same, whether it's in Moscow or Beijing or Pyongyang or elsewhere.
Right. And that's one of the key goals of this podcast is to try to educate people, not just in the U.S., but the world. One of the more dramatic elements that took place at the Congress was the ouster of Hu Jintao. And that's left a lot of experts scratching their heads as to why this happened. It was clearly a power move by Xi. During his speech, he talked about weak leadership of the past and that he's trying to rectify the crisis in the Communist Party. It could have been something as simple as he was opposing Xi Jinping's third term in power and would have raised his hand in opposition, so they got him out of there. What's your take on the ouster of Hu Jintao during the Party Congress?
Well, to my mind, it's the recognition and that Xi Jinping is in absolute control of the Chinese Communist Party. Jiang Zemin, of course, who preceded Hu Jintao, was not present, right? And Jiang Zemin has a faction opposed to Xi, mm-hmm. who had been seen as an ally of Xi Jinping. Mm-hmm. But it's quite clear that Xi Jinping will not tolerate any opposition, whether from the Deng or Zhang faction or whether from Hu's faction, who was really an ally of a kind for Xi Jinping. So it was, as you observe, Bill, exactly right. It's a power play. There's only one leader. As Stalin was the totalitarian leader of the Soviet Union, so now, and Mao Zedong was an earlier period for the Chinese Communist Party, now Xi Jinping is the dominant leader of the Chinese Communist Party. And there can be no mistake. Even though there are other factions in it, they're impotent against Xi's power. That was the image he sought to portray. That was the image he sought to advance. And he did so very successfully and in a very chilling way. And whether that lasts or not, of course, is a matter for history and a matter for the future. But nonetheless, where we are today, Xi Jinping is a hyper-aggressive leader who's risk-accepting in control of the Communist Party of China, and the CCP is in control of China, which means that there is a very potent and hostile adversary to the United States and the free world, and the free world needs to respond to that, and that's the job of the Biden administration to do so. And again, to underscore, they failed to do this. That has a tremendous opportunity cost, and time is passing. Bismarck had that great line about how God looks out for drunks and for little children and for the United States of America. Well, I fear we're essentially taxing his forbearance with respect to the United States. We cannot go on simply expecting that the United States is going to be able to get along and that there'll be harmony in the Sino-American relationship. China has declared us, Xi Jinping, the Communist Party of China, have declared us to be an enemy. And we have not acted like that. We have not responded to our enemy when he has said that he, in fact, is our enemy. And that is, a response is overdue. It has to be complete, whole of society, whole of government, in conjunction with our allies in the free world and our allies within China. And that requires leadership. And Bill, I'm sad to say we don't have it from the Biden administration.
Okay, in the short time we have left, tell us a little bit about your book, Understanding the China Threat.
it's a work that I wrote with Lin Chao Han, is a wonderful co-author, an exceptional individual, which explains to audiences why the Chinese Communist Party is a threat to the United States. The argument that we make is that the ideology of the Chinese Communist Party is one which is inherently aggressive, as Marxism, Leninism, Stalinism, Maoism is inevitably against the West. And so it compels a response. The Chinese Communist Party has been at war with us in the United States, in the free world, since it came to power in 1949. And it has waged war against us through many different means. Again, Bill, your work on this has been exceptional in terms of the ways that ideological measures, diplomatic measures, economic measures, et cetera, with which they've waged war against us, but it compels a response. We also argue that ideology is our most powerful weapon against the Chinese Communist Party. Freedom is going to be preferred over tyranny. And so as long as the United States is a force for freedom and a force for liberty in international politics, it has a tremendous ideological advantage at undermining an illegitimate government, which is what the CCP is. It is the Communist Party of China is illegitimate. It wasn't voted into office. It seized power and it rules in a tyrannical manner over the Chinese people. And so advancing freedom, particularly within China, as well as fully abroad in international politics, is a very powerful weapon to underline the illegitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party and seek to advance its overthrow. We suggest, finally, in the book that we need to have a strategy of victory, and that is that the U.S., as the leader of the free world, has to develop a strategy of victory, explain what that strategy is, and execute it. And if it does so, it will have tremendous advantages within China as well as international politics, so that the future of the 21st century is bright for liberty and freedom in international politics, and tyranny once again can be defeated.
We've been talking with Bradley Thayer. He's director of China policy at the Center for Security Policy and co-author of the book, Understanding the China Threat. Brad, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much indeed, Bill. My pleasure.
That's it for this episode of Victory Over Communism. I'm your host, Bill Gertz. Again, look to the website, victoryovercommunism.net, to see podcasts and other information and to provide feedback. Once again, thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Victory Over Communism with award-winning national security journalist Bill Gertz, the only program in the free world unafraid to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how the Communist Party of China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. See you next time on Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.